Need to order. And we'll take up Senator Rest's Senate File 1297. The discussion started on that. I would anticipate that members will be checking in and out. There are other committees that are working, so it's not unexpected that they wouldn't probably be right here.
Mr. Chairman, then I have Senate File 1297, and I have an author's amendment, the A1. These chairs are really low. They're like I'm sitting on a stoop.
Do we have the A1 amendment?
Yes.
It's a dinner packet.
Your staff had it earlier.
A1 197.
Yes.
Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment.
Yes.
To the amendment.
I will briefly explain it, even though it's an author's amendment. The bill, 1297, does deal with the MnPRAS program, which is an express lane program operated in the metropolitan area that relies on congestion pricing and currently is used on Highway 394. If you have driven on that, the HOV lanes are also MnPath lanes. And then as part of a UPA project that's along 35W, there are MnPath lanes there as well. And the bill is giving MnDOT authority to, with the amendment, to extend the authority to have a MnPath lane to an additional corridor. The original bill was more broadly, the authority was more broadly given, but in the amendment worked out with the chairman, we have narrowed it to just the one corridor, which is on 35E now, with the intersection of 94 and 694. And effectively, what the amendment does is to strike all the new language until line 24, so it just says an additional lane. It would say then an additional lane on each side of that segment of Interstate Highway 35E between its intersection with Interstate 94 and its intersection with Interstate Highway 694. There may be another article that we need to put in there because the next word would be corridor in the department's Metro District Highway Investment Plan, I think. Oh, no, we deleted the new language there, too. So it's all of it's gone. I'm sorry. All of it's gone, and it is just that one corridor to invest in a MnPath lane. And the department is here, the person who deals with MnPath for the department can answer any questions or give any testimony, or if you want to know more about them, the MnPath lanes. We have had this program in place since
2005.
The law was passed in 2005, and then the UPA project was in 2009.
Nine and 10.
Is in 2009 and 10.
I'd like to start by saying thank you for working with us on the amendment.
Absolutely.
And addressing our concerns about the broadness of the original
yes.
bill.
Appreciate that.
And Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, on the amendment, I see
35 either. Any discussion about higher speed limit in there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Zelka, no.
And Mr. Thompson, welcome to the committee.
Sure. Yes, for the record, my name is Nick Thompson with Minnesota Department of Transportation. I'd be happy answering questions about MinPass on the system. We also provided a handout, given an update on the operations of MinPass on 394 and 35W. 35E is selected as our next corridor. That was the result of a study undertaken by MinDOT that was completed last fall and adopted into the region's transportation plan that envisions MinPass system as part of our, as we add capacity to our corridors, we'll be adding MinPass lanes to these corridors in the future. 35E, through this planning study, came up as the next priority corridor for a couple of reasons. It's a congested corridor, definitely congested corridor. It also had a major project that was scheduled, the I-35E Cayuga Bridge, which was a project scheduled to replace the bridge there. And as we were doing that, they're building in the capacity to have a future lane. But as the study showed, we believe we're able to build a very successful MinPass lane on that corridor to be built with that Cayuga project. So not only will we fix a bridge problem on that corridor, we'll also add capacity to that corridor. The future corridors that would come out of the study, in the handout that you would have, kind of lists other future corridors, and we could come back at that time. None of those are funded at this point. So this amendment really would work for the corridor that we have, that we'd start to get underway in the design phase right now. And construction could start as early as 2012 with completion in 2015 and open to the public.
And Mr. Chairman, if you look on, in the handout, for those that aren't familiar with the highway system exactly in the metropolitan area, the map that at the end, next to last page, the red corridor would show you where the MinPass, where this bill proposes the new MinPass corridor to be. And again, currently, it is along 394 and then 35W, and that's in the darker gray for the UVA picture.
Senator Rest and Mr. Thompson, or Mr. Thompson, could you talk a little bit about the fiscal note? I see there's some numbers on there. And just kind of explain what we're talking about as far as the fiscal impacts?
Sure.
Mr. Thompson?
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this fiscal note we just completed before this hearing. The other part of the language proposed cleans up the language that was proposed, or as we built 394, there was specific language about what we do with the revenue and how it used for operations or to pay back the cost of constructing the 394 system. And then when we built the 35W MinPass system, another set of language was passed that kind of defined where the revenue, how the revenue would be used from the 35W MinPass system. Between the two corridors, they were different language, and it was kind of complicated to administer. And so the proposed changes here kind of make our revenue language the same for all MinPass corridors. And with that, the first and foremost, you go to pay for the operation, revenue is used to pay for the operations of MinPass. And then excess revenue, if there is any above that, is shared between MinDOT and Met Council for Transportation Investments. The fiscal note relates to the fact that the current language has a sharing revenue with Met Council a little bit earlier in the process. On 35W, we share some of the toll revenue right out of the gate. And then in this instance, the revenue sharing with Met Council would come after we pay operations, not before. And so there's a projected possible fiscal impact to Met Council under that scenario, and I believe that's the key part of the fiscal note.
And Mr. Chairman, I think it needs to be emphasized, too, that the dollars have to be spent to improve the corridor with regard to where the fees come from.
Where the fees come from.
So, Mr. Chairman, could we adopt the amendment?
Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill? Senator Little?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, this is actually my first crack at MPAS and all of these issues that are associated with it. I guess I'm looking for a little more clarification. Let's start back a few steps. How do we communicate with residents, businesses in the area that we're going through this process? How do they know that this section of freeway is being converted from free to a paved section? And I know it's lanes, but what is our communication process with the public as we contemplate adding this section to the paved structure?
Mr. Chairman, if I could talk to that first, and then Mr. Thompson can talk about this specific project. When we first proposed MPAS, we had a citizens advisory group that also actually included some legislators and the council. People, I think, were involved, the mayors along the corridor, like in Golden Valley, Minnetonka,
Plymouth.
And we met fairly regularly for 6 or 7 months talking about things like signage and access points for buses. There was a lot of actually controversy over access points because the bus operations wanted more frequent access points, but the studies were showing that that instead of speeding up the travel in the general lanes, it would have either been a safety issue or it would not help the congestion at all. And the MnDOT and Met Council were extremely responsive to the citizens group that met. And I don't know whether they're going to, but it was just getting it going, you know. And we did have to have special permission from the U.S. Department because it's on the 394, what were HOV lanes, and there are restrictions on how you can use HOV lanes, but congestion pricing, dynamic pricing for single occupant vehicles became a waiver for that use. And but I thought that scenario was very successful, so that when the corridor opened to MnPass vehicles, there was I think a lot. There was a there was also a publicity campaign, or not to try and say, okay, all you people that want to drive by yourself, you know, use this, but an educational campaign so that people would either know that they had the opportunity to use the bus, to use carpools, and that the MnPass program was going to be available to them. And since that time as well, as you can see from the handout, there's been a lot of studies over its its success. They responded to things like what the absolute maximum charge could be, and when lanes should be just that weren't dedicated lanes, when they should be open. And I would suggest that if they're not going to do that, is that your district, Senator Lilly? or it would be your constituents using it, I would imagine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, it's not exactly my district, but my business serves that area. The newspapers are in that area.
Sure.
And I have been somewhat busy with things the last couple of months here
sure.
in the Capitol, so I haven't read all my newspapers, but I don't recall any stories about this in the papers that serve that area.
Well, that you know, I would recommend that model in terms of getting the word out as the project goes forward. And I think that there's been general satisfaction, certainly among my constituents. I live north of 394, not close to it at all, but a lot of my constituents use 394, and they use that very successfully.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd also like to add to that. There's a couple public involvement pieces that we've done. The regional planning process that was undertaken last year with the Met Council and supported by MnDOT adopted the MnPass system into the policy plan. So we had the map very similar to this, and there was some public outreach and public hearings about the general regional concept. And then since this corridor, if this corridor moves forward, we will follow a multi-phase public engagement process, including what we're doing here is not converting an existing lane to a paid lane. We're adding a new lane to this corridor in each direction. And with that, we are required, and we always want to do a very extensive outreach about the construction of the project. There's an environmental process through all this that engages the public. The cities along the corridor are part of the process to pass and approve the addition of capacity through municipal consent on this process. So we'd be going out extensively through public meetings, town hall meetings. We are looking to engage. This is different because we're not just adding a lane, we're adding a whole new concept. We know there's an education component to what this is that's over and above a traditional project that MnDOT would do of just adding a lane. So as we move into this, we'll have a pretty extensive, and it won't be just the corridor. We'll try to target those that would be using the corridor, so it's commuters coming to downtown or businesses, and so.
And similarly.
Very similar, yep. And what we've done with 35W is we adopted the recommendations of the task force that for 394. So I could envision we try to keep the same policies through all corridors in many ways, but we would definitely be engaging in a very extensive way for this corridor about what it is, what we're doing, and the time frames and the impacts they would have.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, so if I could inquire as to the timeline, that if we were to say yes to this, what is the scale, what is the timeline, and when does this process sure. all get started?
Mr. Thompson?
Yes. Currently, the construction phase would be we'd start construction in the end of 2012 with the major bridge project, and the MnPass portion of that to the north could be part of that project, or start a little bit later with the ideally have them the whole corridor kind of rebuilt by the end of 2015. But that's the construction phase of the public involvement process. Actually, we had our first public meeting around the 35E Cayuga Bridge project just a few weeks ago, so we've already started that. But the public involvement process would really be ramping up very soon because you want that before you start construction, plus through construction. And then so the benefits would start to be realized by the drivers in 2015.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing me to ask a number of questions.
Not at all.
I guess that I'm curious what our plan is with this bill. Is this included in the omnibus? That would be the direction. So we will have further opportunities to talk about this. Before it were passed.
That's our plan, Senator Lilly, is it's not currently in the delete all, but we will amend the delete all to include this bill.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would like to have the opportunity to talk with some of the civic leaders in those communities, and I will make that commitment to do that, to talk to some of the civic leaders and start to formulate some or understand what their positions on this are. And they may be further along in this than I'm aware of, but I'm not aware of this until we see this today. And I would think that this is a large impact on people, many people, for a wide area in the East Metro area. And I would think we would want to have very strong conversations with them. So personally, I'm very cautious about this. It does not feel very comfortable to me, and I guess that's what I'm trying to say
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rust.
Senator Lilly, I can't tell you how much I would welcome another suburban legislator, quite frankly. And now in the East Metro, becoming an expert in the questions to ask, who to talk to, and I would love to work with you on that and perhaps overcome your caution. I myself am a MenPass junkie, and it's an addiction, I have to tell you.
And MnDOT will offer whatever we can to help explain how it works and any details or any way you'd like us to come.
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rust, I think I was looking through the data, I don't know which page, I don't want to go back to it, but after the first year, it basically more than cash flows, I think.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelko, you know, they do studies on the usage, and who does it, and who uses them. And you know, when I'm late coming over here, which is like every day, I use MnPass. And but it's also the case that people that use it are people that are late getting to their daycare, and for 50 cents or 75 cents, they can get to their daycare and not have to spend $5 a minute for being late picking up their kids, or people for other reasons that really do need to have a reliable way of moving from point to point from the suburbs into downtown Minneapolis and out. And of course, it also facilitates at certain points of the day traffic for sports venues downtown and so forth. And of course, those lanes are open to carpools, and they're open to that's where the bus traffic goes. So the bus traffic is in the MnPass lane. It's not in the general traffic. And part of the whole goal, it's not so much who uses the MnPass lanes, it's to make sure that the general traffic lanes are moving as smoothly and with as many cars as possible. It might seem counterintuitive, but that's really the goal, is to move the general lane traffic as swiftly as possible.
Senator Rust and Mr. Thompson, could you also speak to Section 3 and 4 of the bill? We're making some changes to where the monies in all of our MnPass lanes are going, and just some clarification and maybe give some comfort to the committee on how you're going to do that, because previously you were putting the money from these various lanes into separate accounts so that we could see how they were cash flowing, how that was all working, but now this will change that, and if you'd explain that.
Mr. Thompson can explain the details, but the idea is to make it consistent and to have one general policy that will cover not only the current MnPass lanes and the one that's proposed, but if we go forward with other ones in the next 10, 15 years, that there would be a system in place so that you wouldn't have to reinvent it every time. But you can
sure. The details are that we know exactly which road people pay the tolls on, so we try to track by separate accounts the tolls paid by 394, tolls paid by 35W. What gets a little complicated is there's one kind of system operating both. And so the expense side of it is kind of spread across the two corridors for the back office, the customer service, the marketing to the food customers. So this would greatly simplify that. The other thing is that how we account for the revenues is by corridor, but what we are allowed to spend the revenues on is different for each corridor. 394, we have to track paying back the capital cost. At 35W, we do not have to do that tracking. So this really simplifies that. So it really would still retain that the money is used for paying for the system and the operation of the system, and then it is used for transportation and transit investments on the highway system. It wouldn't be used for other items, so it's tied to that.
Is it correct to assume then that the 394 MinPass lanes, would they be paying then for the construction costs or the operation and maintenance costs of the 35E section that will be built now?
Sure.
And that'll all be diluted into one pot of money and used to pay for those, sure. That?
Mr. Chair, we would pay the construction of 35E we're not planning on using toll revenue, existing toll revenue, to pay for that construction. That's being paid with our trunk highway funds and to build the Cayuga project and our traditional construction project funds. Now, we would be using all three pots to pay for the one single back office operation. So we wouldn't, so all three roads would be paying for that back office operations. And, you know, paying for things like the toll equipment, if it had to be replaced. They're going to be of different ages, and some on 394 would be replaced sooner from 35E. So we take the one system and say, pay for those expenses related to tolling or to the operations, but kind of putting it in one pot to pay for those specified by the law, what would be eligible to be paid for from that. So it is a change from today's practice of trying to track it by corridor.
Will this eliminate our ability then to also understand where the revenue is coming from? In other words,
we'll still continue to track exactly where the tolls are paid. That won't change at all.
Thank you for that. Any other questions, committee? Senator Rest.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1297 be laid over. Is that the motion you would like? And then I would offer the amended version as an amendment to the your omnibus bill.
And Senator Rest, we will hold over Senate File 1297 as amended. Put it in the omnibus policy, though. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
We'll take up Senate File 920. And just so, Senator Hall. Senate File 920 is a reporting bill for the expenditures of major highway projects, and I think what we'll do is have Ms. Donahue and Ms. Bodine come to the testifiers table and give us some history on the bill and what we are trying to accomplish by this. And we'll just go through it section by section. But just so the committee understands, this is the vehicle bill for the omnibus policy bill, and what we will do is adopt a delete all amendment, which includes this provision in the delete all. But I wanted the committee to be clear on what the provisions are of this bill as we move forward with the omnibus policy, though. So, Ms. Donahoe, would you like to start?
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. We're a statewide coalition of organizations, both public sector and private sector, that are all involved in building and operating Minnesota's transportation system. I'd like to thank Chairman Gimsey for introducing this bill and the committee for having so much interest this session in looking at how funds out of the Trunk Highway Fund are being spent and making sure that that information is being tracked and that the legislature is really on top of how the funds that you all appropriate are spent by the department. Alliance members and partners like the Minnesota Chamber worked very hard in the last few years, and particularly in 2008, to get a transportation funding bill passed that provides additional revenue for transportation. And we all have an interest in making sure that those funds are being spent as efficiently and effectively as possible, and to make sure that, from our perspective, as many projects and investments that we can have in our transportation system are being made. In addition, recently I'm sure you've heard about some of the bids that have come in for some major projects around the state that have been surprisingly low. For example, on the Hastings Bridge project, and the engineer's estimate was around $220 million for that bridge, and the contract award was closer to $120 million. So we've seen some very significant savings with some of these projects that have been let, and that always raises some questions in terms of what is the impact of that on the rest of the program, and will additional projects be able to be accelerated? Will additional work be out there to bid on? And so we wanted to make sure that you all are getting enough information to understand what happens not only with the plans that come out like the STIP or the 10-year plan or the 20-year plan, but as things change, what the impact is on the program, what happens with projects, and to make sure that that information is current by having annual reporting on what's happening with these projects. A few years back, the Alliance supported legislation that was carried at that time by Representative Simon and Senator Latz to create a major projects report. And it is something that does exist, is in current law. There's also a biennial trunk highway expenditure report that's in existing law. And so working with the chamber, our intent was to combine those reporting requirements into one report, so the department isn't coming out with two separate reports, and to require that report annually as opposed to the biennial report. And so I've provided a handout, I hope you all have, and what this does is it shows you some of the information that is being provided through the major projects report. The last report came out January 15th of 2011, and the department does do a really good job of providing a good snapshot of the major projects in the state. This is a 15-year look at major projects, and as you can see, this is categorized by MnDOT district. So you can see it starts out with District 1, all of the major projects that are anticipated in the next 15 years. And for purposes of Greater Minnesota, a major project under current law is considered a project worth $10 million or more. In the metropolitan area, the current threshold is $25 million or more higher is a major project. And so you can see by district the projects that are anticipated out the next 15 years. And then behind that spreadsheet, I've provided a couple of examples of specific projects. So the report provides a snapshot for each major project, and it does provide some really important information. It talks about why the project is needed, the project history, and from our perspective, most importantly, if something has changed, if there's a delay in the letting date, you can see that that has happened. There should be a description of why that happened. And then ideally, what we'd like to see is what is the impact of that. And in this particular example on I-35, St. Louis River to Boundary Avenue in District 1, you can also see that the cost is increased. So there was a delay. The original letting date was 2011. It's now 2013. And you can see there's also a cost increase, which often happens. And you can see in the description of kind of why that happened, there was a cut to the state road construction program in fiscal years 2010 to 11, and that pushed the project out to fiscal year 2014. So this is the kind of information that this report provides. We think it's really important information for the legislature to be paying attention to be on top of, and to understand the impacts of what happens with either funding reductions or project delays or lower bids coming in, to make sure that you understand kind of the ripple effects of what happens with all of these projects when those kinds of things happen. The next page in the handout is from the current biennial trunk highway expenditure report. Currently, the law requires the department to provide information on 2 years' worth of spending in all of these 10 categories. It's not terribly specific in terms of how the dollars were spent, and it is a 2-year total. So we think that it would be important to have a 1-year report so you can see how things change from the first year of the biennium to the second year of the biennium, and to have more specific information in terms of how these dollars were spent. The last page of the handout I provided just to show kind of where we think that this should be headed is to provide you all with a lot more easy to understand information. So when you provide money in the budget bill for the construction program, for the operations and maintenance budget, you can see how those funds will be distributed around the state. And this table shows you for the state road construction program kind of the money that goes out to all the districts, then the money that's controlled by the central office, the money that, or the funding that's provided through trunk highway bonds, and then other funding initiatives. And this is both state and federal dollars. So we think that this is really important information. The legislation that you're considering today is really, our intent is to have it provide this kind of information on an annual basis so that you can see how the funds are being spent. And then the last part of the bill calls for an audit, which could also be done internally by MnDOT's audit office, but to look at the different systems that they have in place for the construction management system, program and project management, pavement management, and the bridge management system to make sure that those are really providing the best information to the department and then to the legislature.
Ms. Donahoe, I see members are looking at the bill, and I'm glad they're scouring through it, but we would like to pass out the A2 amendment. And, yeah. Just so that we have clarity here, and that's what the bill is trying to do. We want to do that also. But what the A2 amendment is actually a delete all amendment to 920. And this language is what is in the other delete all amendment, which is the omnibus policy bill. So just so that we're all on the same page. The A2 amendment, yeah. So You'll see those changes. The independent audit is no longer there. We give the commissioner the option of either using internal auditors or an independent auditor in the delete all. So we just want you to be reading from the same bill as what is actually in the omnibus policy bill there. So if you would like to continue, otherwise,
that's
Ms. Bodine?
Pretty much all I had.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lisa Bodine with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm the manager of transportation policy for the chamber. And the Minnesota Chamber supports Senate File 920, and we thank Senator Gimsey for bringing it forward. We support the modifications to the trunk highway expenditures and major highway projects report requirements. We believe that the modifications enhance the information that's already provided to policymakers and stakeholders. It's important for us to note that we as a chamber are supportive of and encouraged by MnDOT's flagship initiatives that they've presented to you over the course of this session, and the progress that the department has made over the past years, particularly regarding the design build process, performance-based design, and safety measures. And we appreciate these innovative approaches and want to ensure that any additional burden is not placed upon the department with the proposed modifications to these reports. As with Ms. Donahoe's testimony, Effective management of MnDOT resources are a high priority for her organization, and they are for ours as well. Ms. Donahoe also testified that there is valid business rationale for the legislature and the public to understand how MnDOT's dedicated funds are being leveraged and managed, ultimately with the goal of completing more projects in our state. And the Chamber believes that these reporting requirements really do set the foundation for improved productivity in both financial and business management practices within the department by providing more consistent, reliable, and relevant data across all districts. And these are really all, these aspects are important to business. We're talking about project estimates, award prices, final costs, comparing, you know, real analytics in terms of, you know, comparing apples to apples as best as possible. And the objective really is that they're feasible for the department to analyze or to implement, that it provides additional report accountability and transparency, and that it also provides a more comprehensive report to be utilized by the department, you as the legislature, and stakeholders like the Transportation Alliance and Minnesota Chamber members. And as is true with any analytical tool, the information is really only as good as what you do with it. And so we're committed as the Chamber of Commerce to work with the Transportation Alliance, the department, you as legislators, to ensure that we do leverage that information each year so we can continue to make good decisions with resources. That, Mr. Chair, we encourage support of the bill, this part of the bill.
Thank you. And it's been good to work with you on this, you know, to reduce some of the sizes of the projects, you know, from the 25 down to 15 and the 10 to the $5 million for the outstate projects. We know going forward that a lot of pavement preservation projects will fall within these areas, and that is going to be the focus of MnDOT. We want to understand how those projects are going, if they're coming in over, why, under, where that money is going to, and just have a better, clearer understanding how things are working there. So appreciate you working out the details with MnDOT on this, and I don't know, see MnDOT is here. They'd like to say a few words about the bill. Thank you. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Peterson from MnDOT, and first of all, I'd like to thank Ms. Bodine and Ms. Donahoe for their willingness to work with the department to try and refine this language so that the implementation of the requirements here would not only provide kind of the least amount of additional effort on our part, but also be consistent with the systems and the business processes that we're currently trying to implement. And a lot of the requirements in here are consistent with some of the efforts, the kind of improvements that the commissioner has tried to implement over time at the department, and so we're really grateful for that. I as most of you probably know, the commissioners, two of the commissioners' key objectives for the department are to increase transparency, and transparency is a key to accountability, and so the objectives of this bill are certainly consistent with that. Having said that, I think there are a couple of things that we would still like to try to work on here. The primary one, I think, being the reduction in the price of the project subject to the reporting requirement, the $15 million and $5 million, just in our preliminary evaluation of how many additional projects this would require us to include in the report. It looks like there's a fairly substantial number, which would require an additional amount of work. And I just heard the chairman's comments that he thinks that that's a good idea. So maybe that's a conversation that we can have. But I just thought I would bring that up. If people are aware of the type of projects that this would require to be reported upon, and those projects are of interest to members, then that's certainly a valid reason for requiring their inclusion. And we'll work with whatever comes out in the final bill, I believe. But it just so members know that this will create an additional cost for the department to comply with, and I don't know if the fiscal note has been supplied for this bill yet, but I haven't seen it myself, but I know in conversations with folks who are putting it together, it was a fairly substantial additional cost. Other than that, I think...
Maybe we could talk about that as we go here. Ms. Boyd, okay. Do we have the fiscal note on that? I don't see it in our packet.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know if I'm going to call it should be in your packet, yes.
Yes,
the amendment may change some things. Just in looking it over quickly, I think maybe a big change might be the biggest expense in 2012 is the independent evaluation of in-depth management systems, and now the option being developed to use the internal auditing system, so that may cut down on that expense quite a bit if that option is exercised. The other changes, I'm afraid I haven't had time to go through them bit by bit in the amendment. So my guess is that the cost on the other, if you're looking at page 3 of the fiscal note, I'm sorry, there's a breakdown of the summary of expenditures. My guess is that those numbers will be comparable even with the new amendment, but again, I haven't been able to piece through it yet.
And Mr. Peterson, since our finance bill is still open, I'm sure that we will be able to work this out with you, and again, like Ms. Boyd said, with the change to offering the opportunity to MnDOT to use their internal financial management personnel, we'll be able to work this out. And so, and committee members, we're very aware. We believe that this is important reporting, and so we'll just work that out between the finance in the finance bill as we move forward in conference committee. Work that out with the department. So, any questions,
Mr.
Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, if it's okay, just on the fiscal note itself, then the reference to the evaluation of the systems. I did talk to our director of audit, and he believes that they can incorporate some of these evaluations into their existing work plan, so it wouldn't be an additional cost to the department. It would just supplant some of the other activities that they have in their work plan currently. So that particular fiscal impact there would be lower. The time frame, if I hear the offer of having the finance bill still open as an opportunity to fund some of these activities, there might be an opportunity to deliver the information more quickly if we were able to hire external evaluators. So beyond that, there's one other item I wanted to mention, and I apologize again to the folks who were up here before me, and I should have pointed this out to them in our earlier conversations, but in the reporting on the cost of construction projects, it seems to me that perhaps there should be a point in time at which projects are subject to that reporting requirement, because some of the projects, I'm not sure which projects we would report on. It's hard for us to go back and look at projects that have been completed already and start to report on them, going back 2 years, but perhaps there's a way to just put a date in there to kind of clarify exactly which projects would be subject to those costs, to the reporting of those costs or something along those lines. So that's the only other thing that I can see in here at this point in time.
Well, we'll continue to work on that, too, as we move forward with this bill. Maybe even before we get to the floor, we can have an amendment ready for the floor to make that adjustment. And we can work that out. That's not going to be a problem. So, any other questions from the committee? Senator Dibb?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'm just curious about the repealer. 51.08, if I haven't been through the... Oh, I'm sorry, I see Section 3 repeals language that not changing. Right, okay, never mind. Just looks like we moved that language up. And then just a question for Peterson, if I may. Thanks, Mr. Peterson. Last year we passed a bill that's new statutes that asked MnDOT to move towards more of a performance-based evaluation. process both prospectively for planning purposes as well as reporting purposes to measure internally and also for purposes of reporting to the
Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I think this is entirely complementary to what was in the bill last year. There are some requirements in there about reporting construction costs. The information would be the same as what's being asked for in this, for example.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I will move the delete all amendment to Senate File 920, which is the omnibus policy bill. And does everybody have a copy of that?
Yeah, sure.
That should be in your packet. The A1 amendment, and what this is the delete all. Let's do that again. I will move the 920 A1 amendment.
Right.
Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, would you like me to move that amendment?
Since I'm a member of the committee and it's my bill, I guess I could do that. If you would.
Yeah. I will move that amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Cruz. And I think what we'll do is have Ms. Berzovsky go through and do the delete all and refresh our memories as to the bills that are included in this and section by section, then we'll entertain amendments.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rust.
Ms. Berzovsky, as you're going through it so that we could mark the bill, could you indicate whose bill it is
that we're also having copies made of a rundown of the bills that are in the delete all too, and what sections pertain to that. And we'll get that passed out to the committee members here. Yeah, then you can follow along a little easier.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Is there a plan to move this bill out today?
Yes.
Mr. Chair and members, looking at the A1 amendment, I should mention that there are some things in here that were changed in individual bills by the committee today. So you'll see the old version, and I believe it would be the author's intention to change this draft to conform to the language that the committee had adopted to individual bills earlier today.
So just so the committee is clear, we have adopted already some of the bills that we heard today. I hope that's clear to committee members. Other than Senator Rest's bill on the MinPass lanes, we'll have to.
And Mr. Chairman, we could just agree that the instructions to Senate Council to include in the committee the changes that were made
right
earlier, rather than I have to go back and find where everything is
right,
and just instruct the.
That was our intention. So, and thank you for that, Senator Rest. That's all. Now I think we can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, sections 1-6 are all a part of Senator Gazelka's Senate File 1106, having to do, and some of these were eliminated and will be eliminated from the draft, but the ones that have to do with motorcycle dual registration will be eliminated. But the off-highway vehicle seasonal restrictions, the change in definitions, those will still be a part of the bill, I believe. Section 7 comes from Senate File 1136, and actually that's 7, 8, and 9 and 10. 7 through 10 are part of Senator Wolf's electric assisted bicycles that
that permits the use of electric-assisted bicycles on various types of non-motorized vehicle lanes and pathways. And again, you will not see the amendment yet that was adopted in committee. Sections 11 and 12 are from Senator Howe's Senate File 1077, the MnDOT housekeeping bill. And the first one establishes the Mississippi River Trail and creates a commission. The second one corrects a designation of Veterans Memorial Highway. Section 13 is Senate File 330, Senator Perry's bill, the Liebenstein Memorial Highway designation. And we changed language that was discussed but not really adopted in committee so that the signage will appear in rest areas rather than its specified locations along the interstate. Section 14 is another provision. Actually, I believe this one was deleted from Senator Gazelka's bill earlier, so that will not stay in the bill. Section 15 is from Senator Ingebrigtsen's 672, having to do with conservation officers' unmarked vehicles. And sections 16 and 17 are Senator DeKreif's bill that we heard the other day that repeals the need to re-register a vehicle that's operating with excessive gross weight. Section 18 is 785. Section 18 is Senate File 341, Senator Senjum's bill that has to do with motor vehicle dealers' alternative site record storage so that only two dealers can maintain a single storage site. Section 19 is Senate File 51 that was heard earlier, and that is the amended version of Senator Koch's special plates for women veterans. Section 20 is a Senator Gazelka section. This one may have been, I'm not sure if this one was eliminated in the amendment or not, but this was from Senator Gazelka's bill. Section 21 is another section from Senator Senjum's 341 having to do with motor vehicle dealers' record keeping. Section 22 is from Senate File 1136, Senator Wolf's electric-assisted bicycle definition. Section 23 comes from Senator Gimsey's Senate File 1072, train crew driver license requirements. Then, let's see, sections 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, and 30 are from Senator Gazelka's bill, and I think most of those are the ones that eliminate the reference to four-wheel in the all-terrain vehicle, and there are some other pieces with the local ordinance authority and so on. We discussed this earlier today. That takes us to sections 31 and 32 are from the MnDOT housekeeping bill, which is Senate File 1077. Senator Howe, and those have to do with the yellow flashing signal. Section 33 is a section from the electric assisted bicycle bill, Senator Wolf 1136. Section 34 is Senator Gerlach's Senate File 1098 that authorizes local jurisdictions to allow buses on highway shoulders. Section 35 is Senate File 992, and that is Senator Wolf's bill that requires school bus crossing arms on buses manufactured in or for use in Minnesota. Section 36 is Senate File 532, Senator Vandeveer's use of nonconforming lights on collector emergency vehicles. And this, I believe, does incorporate the amendments that were made the other day in committee. Section 37 is, that is, let's see, Senate File 1124, Senator Wolf's child passenger restraint modification provisions. Section 38 is Senate File 366, Senator Perry's gross weight seasonal increase allowed for transportation of sweet corn. Then sections 39 and 40 are from Senator DeKreif's Senate File 785, having to do with transportation of excessive gross weight. Sections 41 and 42 are from Senator DeKreif's MnDOT overweight permits bill and the allowance of a medical waiver under certain circumstances for interstate travel. Section 43 is another section from Senator DeKreif's 785, the excessive gross weight permit bill. Section 44 is a section from, the other section from Senator Ginsey's 1072, having to do with train crew driver license requirements. Section 45 is Section 49 is Senate File 499, Senator Howe's online driver education provision. Then sections 46, 47, and 48 are Senator Weger's Senate File 1042, driver education on carbon monoxide. Then Section 49 is Senate File 395, Senator Daley's bill extending the driver's license expiration date for military members who are on duty outside Minnesota. Section 50 is, that was Senator Latz's, bill that was just heard a little while ago, Senate File 1219. Section 51 is from Senate File 920, the new language that was just discussed concerning MnDOT reporting. And Section 52 is a section from Senator DeKreif, Senate File 1121, and that has to do with the medical waiver part of the MnDOT trucks bill. Sections 53 and 54 are, oh, wait a minute. Sections 53, 54, and 55 are from Senator Howe's MnDOT housekeeping bill and deleting some obsolete references to a rail service continuation program. Section 56 is from Senate File 471. That is Senator Newman's driver's license reinstatement diversion program expansion. Section 57 is Senate File 132. That is Senator Fischbach's forgiveness of Kanesville debt to the State Airport Fund. Section 58 is from Senate File 920, the language that was just reviewed about MnDOT reporting. Section 59 is from Senator Weaver's bill on carbon monoxide driver education. And that, I believe, brings us to the repealer. And the repealer includes provisions from, I think, three different bills. Senate File 672, Senator Ingebrigtsen's conservation officers' unmarked vehicles. Senator Howe's MnDOT housekeeping bill. Senator DeFrey's repealing of the re-registration of overweight vehicles. And then I think I forgot to put in the repealer that goes with the 920 language. So we'll have to add that in. Oh, it is in there? Oh, okay. Oh, and that concludes the amendment.
Any discussion from the members? A lot to try to recall as we went through this, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, with regard to the last bill, we did have that oral amendment, and so I'm assuming that, at least as far as that goes, that will be reflected in that section. But I was wondering if you were considering, after the Judiciary Committee acted on the bill there, if you were going to put their action on the bill as part of this rather than this. I mean, I share your concern a little bit about that broad authority there.
That's right. I'm glad you brought that to our attention, Senator Rest, that we were going to amend the delete all amendment to take that, the last provision, out of here.
Because you want that bill to move separately?
Right.
Okay.
That's correct.
I'll move that right now.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, that was going to be one of the first things we did.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'll move delete
Section 50, I believe it is.
Section 50, except the Judiciary Committee for this bill on that.
Does everybody on the committee understand what we're doing there? Yeah. Senator Rest moves the oral amendment deleting Section 50 of the delete all amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Eliminate. Any other? Senator Rest, why don't we start with you?
Move to amend the A1 amendment with the amended language from Senate File 597 that we just read. And that's the main thing.
We'll do this all
down and
one at a time.
Okay.
Senator Rest has moved that we amend the A1 amendment with the language.
With
the amended language of 1297. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the A4 amendment, if I may. What it does, it simply mirrors the language that we already contain in the statute that kind of outlines the definition and authorization for commuter rail. It simply says that the contracts that we enter into, if and when we ever do have passenger rail in this state, it simply be consistent with the federal statutes. Respect to federal labor law and And it helps us, Mr. Chair, avoid a couple of things. It helps us avoid having to provide for a significant number of labor provisions in state law if we are to go down this path with respect to safety and I mean, there's just a whole lot that labor law, federal labor law, kind of takes care of that we don't really have to take care of as a state.
So, Senator Dibble, is this in other provisions already in law, this exact language? We would be able to find this in other...
Yes, as I understand, Mr. Chair, this is the same language that we have for commuter rail, North Star Corridor, all the commuter rail line that we have right now. And we have Mr. Qualley here from the UTU. If you have technical questions, and Mr. Peterson can help characterize their non-stance, so...
I'm getting a head nod from Mr. Peterson that they're comfortable with this language. And Mr. Qualley, welcome to the committee.
Chairman Kimsey, committee members, thank you very much. I'm Philip Qualley, for the record, with United Transportation Union, Minnesota Legislative Board. I'm a railroad conductor of 30 years for the Chicago Northwestern Railroad, the Union Pacific Railroad. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Central?
You know, you don't know who they're talked with authority, but everything I've heard in the last couple of weeks about the potential of passenger rail has passenger rail running as a private sector franchise operation. And I don't know, that may just be some view, but I've heard it too many times. If that is the case, does this language fit that kind of a model?
Well,
Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, I don't think anyone's contemplating building a system that would be privately owned. In any case, and I think probably referring to some of the ideas on the table for the Rochester to the Twin Cities connection, maybe working with a public-private partnership to operate, to design, build, operate, maybe operate the system. The ownership and the public responsibility of the right of way, the ownership of the facility itself would be state ownership. So I think we're contemplating a fully private rail system. A public-private partnership is a worthy idea. I'm supportive of examining that very, very much. Very intrigued by that. But in any case, the rail itself, the facility, probably the rolling stock as well would be publicly owned. And this would be kind of the same with that.
Sure, it's probably not defined very well. I just, when people say a franchise operation that will live or die on its ability to economically function, I don't quite know where the lines of, does that mean they're going to do all the maintenance and track updates and all that, or is that, it's just an open question, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if this language would affect that model or not. And probably not.
I have similar questions about it, too, and the presentation that I've seen on that is that it's more private than it is public, and that it is going to stand on its own. Like you say, live or die and on what they can take in fares and other means. So, yeah, I guess that would be my concern. How does that affect these types of public-private projects? But, Mr. Qualley, can you share with us what you know?
This simply sets forth that our rights under the Railway Labor Act, as well as the Federal Employers Liability Act, would not be affected. And the across the United States now, whether it's freight or passenger, you have private operations in freight in particular that operate under these labor laws and have for the last 80 years. Our intent here is really to assure that the level of safety, security, and stability is continued. But to your question, if I may, Senator, or Mr. Chairman and Senator, we're simply saying that our rights would not be affected.
Mr. Chair.
Senator
Sundrum. You know, I don't know, you could speculate BNSF or Canadian Pacific or, you know, if they would take this as a franchising activity, you know, they would take it under some sort of an agreement, I suspect, with the state of Minnesota. And I would only wonder if we're jumping the gun by doing this. I mean, I don't know the answer. These are just all hypothetical things. But if it's truly to operate as a franchise, private sector, live or die operation, I just have those concerns.
Senator Sundrum, I share those concerns. Is this already, would that railway become under the current laws that we already have at the federal level and that we are complying with for the last 80 years? What does this really solve in relationship to that? I would imagine that would have to come under some rail authority on a federal level, just like BNSF or CNN and others. How is this any different than what we are currently required to comply with under federal law? Because virtually everything we do in the state is dictated by the federal rail authority. And well, I'm just curious what this language really does. Is it if we're already required to comply with federal law, why the necessity for this? Senator Dibble?
As I understand, you know, we recognize and we kind of separate and differentiate in our statutes the different models for a number of different reasons. And we have definitions and kind of differentiate matter statutes, provisions and considerations and statutory underpinnings for, you know, light rail, heavy rail, freight rail, and, you know, passenger rail, kind of a new area, which we're getting, so we need to provide for, you know, all the different aspects, make sure that, you know, we're funding them, you know, distinguishing and differentiating how they account for the dollars. You know, and this is a labor piece that has not yet been picked up, which we picked up in at least a minimum of a year ago. We don't have any passenger rail, but we're contemplating it. The rail plan that we've developed now, we didn't have commuter rail ever. Now we do. We have to figure out exactly how we're going to provide for and make sure the state can live within its own statutes remain consistent with federal regs, so it's available law.
So
or else, you know, we contemplate having to take up, you know, significant rulemaking.
So, just a question on light rail. Is that, what authority is that operated as far as the operators and the people who actually blow the whistles and operate those trains? Is that operated under federal regulation? Or is that just state laws? And
well, there are some significant federal regulations that help the state. Rail itself is operated by the Met Council and the folks who operate the light rail line for the whistle are members of the ATU, Amalgamated Transit.
They are?
Yeah, like the bus driver.
Okay. So they are all covered under the federal regulations?
Well, federal regs that intersect with local transit service. This is something that's step above local transit.
Mr. Qualley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could answer a couple questions here. to Senator Senjum's point, it could be a public, with this affirming what has been the trend for the last 80 years, what is accepted practice, we are simply asking the state to accept or affirm with any new passenger authorizing. That passenger could be private. It could be public-private partnership. It could be a public corporation such as Amtrak, which already has these provisions in it. We're simply saying that the rights to the key pieces of the Railway Labor Act, with all of its benefits that keeps the economy moving, that the Railway Labor Act is designed to not have any type of work stoppages of any kind, to keep the economy moving with all the contributions to safety and security that are built into the Railway Labor Act that we participate under, those are all in place, and we simply want to affirm those. As to the light rail piece, if I may say so, this does not affect light rail. There's the federal labor laws, federal labor laws as well as safety laws are in a separate section of the federal code for light rail. Passenger and commuter rail with freight rail are a different animal, if you will. Thank you. I do have a prepared statement that if it would help, and I could explain a couple of the things, but I'd be happy to simply take questions. Again, we, there has been the, Mr. Chairman, there has been a rail plan that hasn't been in place for the last couple of years. UTU has participated in the rail plan as a partner in the Policy and Tech Committee. And in the January 3rd meeting, as well as the February meeting, while the MnDOT rail plan draft is being written on governance and finance, we specifically asked the consultant to MnDOT, is it appropriate to address this issue at this time? And they affirmed that, although that plan is not finished. As railroad workers who are on the lines now, we simply wish we have the right to represent our safety exclusively of any other entity and independent of any other entity. We believe that having this in place and having this affirmed by the state, the commissioner's authorizing powers, will put the state in a better position if we ever do have any rail plan that moves to a point of federal application. Finally, I can tell you that with any federal application for rail service, it will be in the state's, I believe it is in the best state's interest to have this simple issue just simply affirmed in any rating. I cannot speak for the private freight railroads, but we did meet with them, and I know that they're comfortable with this. What this contributes to, once again, is the level of safety, security, and stability in our industry that they want. And, in fact, in the case of the North Star Commuter Rail, they use our BNSF crews to operate that public service. So, essentially, all we're doing is expanding what is commuter rail now to any future passenger rail service that the commissioner would authorize for.
This affirmation aspect of it, too, is if what we are doing here is just affirming something, I just affirming that we will comply with federal law, you know, I just wonder about the necessity of it, too. But Senator Lilly?
Chair, thank you. Senator Dibble, can you tell us what are the protections that one would find in the Federal Employers Liability Act, referring to railroads, and in the Railway Labor Act, Title 45, Chapter 8, and Title 45, Chapter 2? What specifically are these areas of protection that are being offered by this amendment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't have a specific knowledge. Safety, pensions, those sorts of things. Quality knows a lot better than I do.
If I may, the Federal Employer Liability Act was designed to place the responsibility and the expense of injured and deceased railroad workers directly on the rail industry and not on state workers' compensation systems. There's no reason that the state should pick up the cost of workers' comp for railroad workers when we're part of a federal interstate program, or railroad operation. And so that was the federal employer liability is based on. Also, as under the Railway Labor Act, because railroads' labor's voice is recognized, we serve on numerous committees with the Federal Railroad Administration, with the National Transportation Safety Board, with the STB and other areas of rate regulation, on collaborative committees, including the Rail Safety Advisory Committee, and the Switching Operation Fatality Analysis Working Group, which I'm a member of personally. The key there is that those type of collaborative groups under the Railway Labor Act help to push down the FELA claims. Our goal is to have no injuries, no fatalities in this industry. FELA has contributed to the lessening, and I'm pleased to say that our fatality and injury rates are continue to go down across the nation. Again, that's all done because under the Railway Labor Act 1926, we have a voice in this remarkably unique industry in the transportation world. So I hope that answers your question. And finally, the Railway Labor Act is designed, once again, when we think of protections under the Railway Labor Act, you should think about protections for the public and the public good and commerce. The Railway Labor Act is designed to keep the commerce and to keep the economy moving. We are parallel to the military. We are a vital industry, I should say. And, you know, we have all of our dispute resolution processes in place that really serves the public interest. Thank you.
Senator Lilly, follow.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would tend to not be in favor of this, to be opposed to this amendment. It would seem to me that the Federal Employers Liability Act and the Labor and the Railway Act probably has precedence over what we're doing here in Minnesota. The federal law has precedence over what we're doing, and perhaps we get clarification to that and make sure that is the case. That being said, I cannot foresee a situation where our commissioner would purposely enter contracts that would put the rights of employees at risk of being modified. And this seems very duplicative to me that these protections are already here, they're already there for these employees. And this contract, I do not see where this amendment adds to what employees have or what we should be committing to as a state.
Maybe call Ms. Berzovsky, do you have something to add as far as what in this arena, whether federal law supersedes state law?
Mr. Chair, as far as I know, that these federal laws would supersede any contrary state law or provision, contractual provision that the federal law would control. As far as I know, and Mr. Qualley can correct me if there are exceptions to that rule in this case.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I am always suspect to question Ms. Berezovsky, but there are two cases, actually three railroad cases since 1999 that have caused the courts, and a disclosure, I'm not a lawyer, but have caused the little bit of confusion as to the state's intention when they started commuter in passenger rail services. Alden versus State of Maine, 1999. 2006, Oshinsky versus Northern Indiana Railroad Operating Commuter Authority, and that has gone on. And there were instances where the state's intent was not clear, and any claims for injury were thrown out that the state did not accept. And I know this sounds counterintuitive. The blanket of federal preemption is supreme. That's the rule of the railroad particularly. But we simply, because of some confusion areas, we wanted to make sure that they're accepted. Let me go on, if I may, Mr. Chairman. We had the Minot train derailment in 2002 in Minot, North Dakota, that also there was some questions about the rulings of the state and federal relationship. Finally, that matter was dissolved with an amendment to the Transportation Security Act of 2007, where they retroactively went back and changed the law to assure that the federal preemption was in place. That is part of what motivates the UTU and rail labor here, to assure that our state's house is in order. The worst case scenario, and I don't mean to horrify the committee for the sake of sensationalism, But it's where if you were to, our concern would be is if you try to have a person come in with an operating scheme that is not adequate and yet it's contracted anyway, and we have workers that really shouldn't be out on the railroad, our interest is the safety and security of our membership as well as the public. And if we have people that are not fully qualified to be out there, that causes us a lot of concern. And the worst case scenario was what happened in Chatsworth, California in the summer of 2008 when a disqualified locomotive engineer was running a commuter service that was substandard, and the United Transportation Union California Legislative Board wrote up to the state the practice that was occurring a month prior to that incident. And in the summer of 2008, an engineer that had been otherwise disqualified made some series of mistakes, and we had a terrible, terrible train wreck out. There were 25 people, including the engineer, were killed. That's what we want to avoid. And because the Railway Labor Act gives labor a voice, because the Federal Employer Liability Act makes sure that those costs and liabilities are not thrown onto the state in a workers' comp or other, scenario. That's why we're trying to move this piece of legislation to make sure that our state has accepted the federal preempted scheme, the scheme of federal preemption, excuse me.
Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair, do we have a fiscal note on this at all? I know this looks a little better than the last time we talked, because we talked about it, and that writing that you had, the commissioner will take measures to preserve all rights, and I question that, and it's kind of being presented that, this isn't a big deal. It's just reaffirming, what's already in federal statute. But I can't put my finger on it, but there's something in my gut instinct that tells me we're diving into something that we don't fully understand. And if it's being presented as it's not a big deal, there's probably something there that we're going to find out later on there is a big deal. And I don't know, we talk about safety, security, and stability, and that may be in these codes, but I don't presume to know what's in all the railroad safety acts. And I've been involved in the passenger rail forms for the last couple years, and we haven't talked about this, and I don't know if there is any kind of a cost or what it would do, but I certainly think we could have a proper vetting of it. I'm just concerned at this point. I don't have enough information, but something in my gut says we need to dive into it a little further. And at this time, I can't support it because I don't fully understand it enough.
Senator DeCroy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would actually echo what Senator Howe was saying. I have some relatively extensive experience with the railroad over the years, and I've never found the railroad to ask for something that wasn't absolutely in their favor and will move stuff for you, but you're going to take all the responsibility for us moving something for you. And so I also have grown very cautious to the point where the company that I represent doesn't do very much work with the railroad anymore. So to have the state, for me to vote, to have the state take on some responsibility I would feel like I was asking the company that I represent to take on responsibility that I told them I didn't think they should. So I would speak against this at this point, unless this is thoroughly vetted, that I know absolutely where the state's responsibility starts and stops.
Senator Dibble.
I think we know where this is going. I'd like to request a roll call vote on this amendment. I speak strongly in favor. I think my motion speaks strongly in favor of the amendment. I think actually quite the opposite occurs. Senator Price, following the federal measurement, protect the state and the state's interests. But particularly if we get into passenger rail, it's going to be going, across state lines. And I think we want highly qualified people operating these systems. Safety protocols and the safety processes that have been established when it comes to liability issues, et cetera. I think it's very vital.
Well, we'll have a roll call vote.
Senator Dibble, I appreciate that, and we will have a roll call vote, but this may be in other provisions within the law, but there is no animus against, I don't feel, against labor in any way, but we have not heard this, and it would be my preference, if this came as a standalone bill, that we would send it to judiciary, where it would get a thorough vetting by people who probably have a better understanding of this, rather than a transportation committee, where we, for the most part, deal with mechanics and the budget. So I guess I would say that maybe you'd like to revisit this as a standalone bill, and we could move it along that way and have a better, more thorough vetting.
Sure, I have no way of knowing if that'll even get a hearing. We've got a number of bills, and I always submit the hearing requests to you when I submit bills. I haven't heard anything back about whether or not those bills. I don't know if we can chase this omnibus bill with bills that I'm yet waiting hearings on, or what your intention is.
I'm sure that we'll hear this again, Senator Dibble, probably on the Senate floor. But there is as you can see by the members of the committee, there's a level of discomfort with just moving this on without having a thorough understanding of what it is meant to do, or if it's meant to do anything. I guess I'm kind of caught between wondering if we aren't adopting something that is already federal law that we are required to enforce anyhow, and whether it does have repercussions moving that are unseen, unintended consequences. So I think you should at least respect the committee's level of discomfort with this, and if you want to have a roll call vote, we'll have that. So any other discussion on the amendment? Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair, I would just say, I just think there's just a lot of unknowns in this, and I think there's a lot of time to deal. If this is good, there's probably, who knows, 2 to 5 to 10 to 20 years to deal with this one.
Right.
I mean, we don't have the tracks, we don't have the plan, we don't have the money, and we're not going to have it for quite a while, probably. And if this is a good idea, there's time to re-entertain this and adopt it if it is a good idea. And the other thing I would simply say is, I could not imagine the state of Minnesota entering into a contract that would violate anybody's federal rights anyway, and so why do we even need this?
Right.
I mean, that in and of itself would be against the law. And I don't think I'm reading it incorrectly. It says you can't enter into a contract that violates the rights of employees under a federal act. Well, of course we can't.
Same questions I have, Senator Senjum, the necessity of it too. So any other discussion? Roll call has been requested. We'll have a roll call.
Senator Ginsey?
No.
Senator DeCrite?
No.
Senator Dibble?
Yes.
Senator Gazelka? Senator Howell?
Nay.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Lilly?
No.
Senator Lori? Senator Perry?
No.
Senator Reiner? Senator Rest?
Yes.
Senator Senjum?
No.
Senator Sharon? Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Wolf?
There being 3 yeses and 7 noes, the motion does not prevail. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Mr. Qualley, we don't have an amendment in front of us or a bill in front of us that pertains to anything for further discussion.
Simply wish to say thank you very much.
Senator Howell offers the A3 amendment as they're passing it out. If you would
want to...
This has to do with Senate File 499, the drivers online bill, and it cleans up some language and working with DPS and other things. The most significant change, substantive change in it, is Section 47. That there would be no more than 3 hours of instruction per day for a student that chooses to do the online education part.
Ms. Berzovsky, is there any additional? I see a lot of points.
Mr. Chair, no. The rest is, I believe, is just cleanup and technical.
Any questions or discussion by the members? Senator Howell moves the A3 amendment. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion on...
Senator, Mr. Chairman, on page 3 of 26, section 13, I'm not sure what happened here, but the language under subdivision 70 is totally different than the language that we laid on the table from Senate file number 330.
Is this the
section 13? And I guess with that in mind, having just seen this, I would like to do an oral amendment, which would delete section 13 and replace it with the language from Senate File 330 that had been laid on the table prior to.
Certainly, if we didn't get the language right, or did we do something?
Mr. Chair, that's the one that I think I mentioned in the walkthrough of the bill that I had included language that I believe that I was directed to include that that had the signage at rest areas rather than at specific locations on the highway. It was language that was discussed at the hearing, but it was never voted. It was not offered or voted on at that time.
Senator Burr.
And Mr. Chairman, I guess I have issue that, and I also believe at that time we had said that there would be some discussion with MnDOT on this, and there has not been any. And so that concerns me. That the bill that was brought forward was changed and without any discussion. I would have liked to have that happen. Now it gets so restrictive, and it wasn't the original intent or wishes. And I think we all understood that, but I still feel that we should include the same language that was laid on the table. And
so Senator Perry, just so I'm clear, did we amend your bill?
No.
So, and this language is not the same as?
I've got the original language right here in Senate File 330, and that's what I checked on right away to make sure and it has changed drastically. Section B has changed quite a bit from the Section B. Well, it's totally different than the Section B in the original Senate file.
Senator Perry, maybe we should get copies of that to all of the committee members, and we can offer it as an oral amendment using that language. Is that how you would do that? Okay. While they're making copies, Senator Kreif, did you have an amendment that you'd like to offer?
Yes. The A6 amendment on Senate File 920, the bill that we heard on Tuesday, essentially it came with about a $750,000 fiscal note.
Senator Kreif moves the A6 amendment. Senator Kreif on the amendment.
Yeah, what we did is we met with MnDOT, and essentially what this amendment does is it takes the provision of raising the weight, the registered weight on a vehicle, it takes that away. We won't be actually raising the registered weight, but the fee that we charge for raising that registered weight would actually still be in effect. So it would be a prorated amount that they would still charge, and it would get Minnesota more in line with other states around the nation that I've done business with. So it would simplify the process, actually, and has some potential of maybe even bringing in more money, because what's been happening in the past is when somebody obtains an overweight permit, they're also told by MnDOT to go raise your registered weight in your vehicle to that higher weight, and many people don't. So this actually will ensure that the money will be coming in for the additional weight. But at this point, MnDOT, the way they basically explained it to me is they're pretty sure this will end up being a fiscal neutral note. It should be zeroed out, but there is potential that we can't count on of it maybe even being a plus.
So this is language that you worked out with MnDOT and DPS to
yes, and
solve that.
Rubowski helped as well. So
yeah, I know you did a lot of work on this in the just the two short days that you had to work on it. And
I do want to mention, Mr. Chair, that we got together with six MnDOT employees, and we all put our thinking caps on, and we came up with some solutions to, and I thank them because they started thinking outside the box and came up with a good solution. I didn't think it had to be as difficult as it was on Tuesday, and it turned out that they agreed. So they helped come up with a very good solution, I think.
Senator Rust.
Chairman, did you also get rid of the impact on DPS?
Senator DeCray.
In my talk, and DPS is here, we might ask them about it. Mm-hmm. Essentially, there was some fees that they wouldn't be bringing in, but on the flip side, they wouldn't be doing the work either. So essentially, they would have, you know, probably less staff. So I don't know if Ms. McCormick is interested in speaking to that or not.
Ms. McCormick, welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick with DVS. And the concern was there may be a few little tweaks. That's what I'm getting an email back, because my program director wasn't aware of some of the changes that needed to be made after you looked at it again and thought that, you know, that first option you had chosen may need some more tweaks to it. But I think we can take care of it. I think she relayed her concerns to MnDOT, so I think there may be just a slight some changes, but nothing major as far as I'm concerned from what she emailed me. So, but there may be a few changes that need to be made just to accommodate our process from what she was saying. So she's talking to MnDOT about it right now. But I can't give you any more details than that because I think she wants to work with MnDOT, but we need a few more. There's a few things that need to be worked out.
Senator Rust.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cormier, what you're suggesting is maybe, as this bill moves forward with this amendment on it, that there just might be a need for some technical adjustments so that the impact on DPS is moved along.
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, yes, I'm not sure that the total fiscal impact will be neutralized, but I don't think that would be a deal breaker for us. But I think our main concern is that our customers are satisfied and that we have something that's streamlined and efficient. And so I think that's more what the concerns are that my program director mentioned in her email to me, but I haven't had a chance to talk to her about it. So.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Any other discussions on the A6 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Hall, I'm sorry, too close.
Mr. Chair, I would offer the A8 amendment. And, if we would, Mr. Chair, could we have Senate Counsel explain this?
Senator Hall moves the A8 amendment. Ms. Berzovsky?
Mr. Chair and members, the A8 amendment amends a section of statute that has to do with the distribution of fine revenues for violations of the Minnesota Child Passenger Restraint Law. And what it does is it adds two additional classes of recipients for distribution of fine revenues, and those are school districts and child care providers. But only those that provide school transportation and vehicles using type 3 vehicles or school buses under 10,000 pounds. So this is intended to help mitigate the impact of the provision that was the standalone bill that is rolled into this delete all amendment that will require these buses under 10,000 pounds and type 3 vehicles to be subject to the booster seat law.
I'm glad to see that we were able to work through some of the problems that were occurring there with the costs associated with this provision. Any discussion on this? Senator Seba?
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious, Senator, how does DPS support this amendment?
Senator Hall?
Mr. Chair and Senator Segan, I am not aware whether they do or not, but I see Ms. McCormick down at the end. She could probably tell us what DPS thinks about it.
It's not really her department, but Ms.
Okay.
McCormick, if you could.
I'll try and resolve that. Sir.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, unfortunately, I'm emailing away trying to find out, and so I really can't tell you right now because I have been in meetings almost a whole day, so I really am not up on other divisions within the department right now. Unfortunately, I apologize.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can tell you that I was pulled off the floor today and that we were discussing this exact same what I brought up at committee last time. And I said, just find a way that we could help. I don't know how we do it. When I saw this come out tonight, I thought they found you and they were working pretty quick. And Lieutenant,
yes.
I can't
can't think of his name that was in committee yesterday. I think it was yesterday, wasn't it?
Carol.
We specifically talked, and they understood that was my only concern, is that we find a way to have some funds so that we can include child care providers and school districts based under whatever rules that they are under here, that we could some way find some relief from the expense. So I, from that conversation, that's where I thought this came from. I thought they wanted to work on it right there. So I would think they would be in support.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair and Senator Perry, I appreciate that, but Senator Wolf is the one who's worked on this, and she can't be here, so she's the one that I just offered it because she's in education right now.
Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I had the exact same conversation.
Did you?
Outside the chambers today and asked for the same thing.
Yeah.
I'm inclined to support this amendment. I would be curious to know what this money goes to, what might be not getting as much. I do appreciate it comes from the fines and not from the federal grant money that we get. And that money is pretty important reserved for providing booster seats to women, in particular, public and the public education. So, but, you know, even if I do understand what it's not going to be,
I'm trying to recall what Ms. Marty, the department, was saying yesterday about where those dollars actually go. Senator Seep?
I can't shed any light on that, Mr. Chair. And I mean, I think this amendment is fine, but I have a question as it relates to, perhaps council can answer this. So are we carving out any new exceptions in the bill that's before us, not counting the amendment? It looks like we're adding provision for a school bus that weighs more than 10,000 pounds. So am I reading that correctly, that now there's more vehicles that will be exempt? Or am I getting confused?
Ms. Berzofsky?
Mr. Chair and Senator Steven, actually the effect of the language that the effect of the language is to withdraw certain classes of vehicles from the exceptions to the booster seat law, to make them subject to the booster seat law.
Senator Stevens, does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Howell has moved the A8 amendment. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Perry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I need to read?
Why don't we hand out
the actual Senate File 330 has been handed out.
Not quite yet.
Being handed out now. And I guess what my concern is that Section B, starting with B on Senate File 330, which is line 1.13 through 1.22, was completely deleted from what we see here under Section 13, Subdivision 70. And as I go through this, I know it looks like a lot. When we discussed it, what this really was showing is that their intent was to see a sign on the on or off ramps, and one sign on Highway Interstate 35, and I believe that was by the overpass. So when we were discussing this about whether there should be ones in the rest area, they were talking, I think if you recall, about those great big fancy signs, somewhat, well, fairly expensive, what I've been told. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the intent of what
we were trying to do in Senate File 330. The normal sign that you already see that matches what has been used in, I believe, two other areas that size. It was a smaller size. So I guess I'm concerned on this because the change from what we talked about in committee and laid on the table and without any further discussion.
And we want the language that we agreed to put on, to lay on the table, and so
correct.
This is
what it was, and fully knowing that even down the road that there could be some changes.
Some further discussions on it.
Right, absolutely. And that would be my oral amendment is to delete, and however it would be, Mr. Ostrowski, if we delete all of Section 13 and replace it with the language from Senate File 330, that would be my oral amendment.
As introduced.
Right.
Any further discussion on that? We all understand. We've had the discussion about this, and we've had the department up, and the agreement that you worked together with the department to find a suitable. I don't know. Does anybody on the committee want to hear again from the department their concerns? I think we're pretty clear that about their concerns. So, to get this right, Senator Perry moves to amend Senate File 920 as amended with the language from the original Senate File 330 as introduced. That's going to be clear for everybody, including council, so we get it right there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion on Senate File 920 as amended? Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to make a verbal amendment to delete all of Section 56. I believe that is a bill that we did send off standalone. It's on the floor right now, and in the hopes to kind of streamline the process and get this through, not have to send it to judiciary, if we could take that out.
Senator Cruz, your oral amendment would be to remove all of Section 56?
Correct.
In the bill? Any discussion? Senator Russ?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Newman, what is the status of it at this point? Don't you have general orders?
That's correct, Senator.
Do you know what's happened to it in the House?
I don't, Senator. Is anybody?
Senator,
not that it matters
Mr.
what happened.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, in general, I would support your motion, but I would be interested to know if the Senate wants this bill to happen, but it's not moving in the House, better to leave it in an omnibus bill because.
Senator Rest, we've just been informed that it's on the calendar in the House.
In the House,
so it is moving there too.
Can I support that?
Thank you for the concern. Senator Bibb?
As far as your question, not that I really actually care that much, but I can support whatever.
Well, you care.
Has this issue not yet been vetted by the judiciary committee? Is that the problem? Because if it's been judiciary, there's no problem moving it out in the transportation bill. The subject has already been taken up in the judiciary.
And moved to the floor.
It won't
move
to the bill won't be dragged to the judiciary.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dillon, I don't believe that it has, is what I have been told. So,
And that would be my concern, is that we would not meet the deadlines if we were to have this in there.
And the bill is on the table. The issue is we don't know how it came out of judiciary and whether the language is the same as what we have here. But it is on general orders that has been referred to the floor, so we'll just remove this. I think we're still at the point where we have to go.
So there's no problem with deadline. Okay.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator DeGray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to amend your A1 amendment.
We have a...
Oh, I'm sorry.
We've got the oral.
I'm sorry. Sorry.
Senator Cruz has an oral amendment to strike Section 56 of the bill. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Any further discussion on Senate File 920 as amended?
As the chair.
Senator Craig.
Now I'll go.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to amend your 920 A1 amendment by adding a file that I don't have an amendment number with it, but what it is it's a Senate File 1226. It's actually adding a license plate. It's a Start Seeing Motorcycles plate to this bill.
Okay. That's my concern, Senator DeCryf. We are coming to a conclusion of an omnibus bill in which virtually everything in here has been heard in committee and has an opportunity, we've had an opportunity to have a discussion on it. I would prefer if you would prepare it as a bill for next year. We'll have another policy run or another policy bill next year, or this can go on its own as a separate bill. But I'm reluctant to take on any additional, certainly plate bills or any other policy bills that haven't been heard in committee. So you can offer this as an oral amendment, but I would have to encourage you a no vote on it, and that we don't move down this path.
Okay. I'll withdraw my motion.
I don't think you actually made a motion, but thank you, Senator DeGryf. I'm more than willing to work with you to see that it gets heard next year or... Any other discussion? Then I would, then Senator Cruz moves that Senate File 920, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to Finance. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, committee members, for your hard work on this. I appreciate it. And
we'll see some of you at 6.
See you on the floor.
Kelly?
Huh?
No, I wish I did.
Sorry about that.